It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Yesterday, a leaked preliminary U.S. intelligence report suggested that American strikes to the Iranian nuclear sites did not significantly set back Iran's nuclear ambitions. The Trump administration contests that claim, saying it's flat out wrong and released by, quote, a low-level loser in the intelligence community.
As the conflict unfolds between Iran and Israel, and U.S. officials issue warnings on heightened threats from Iran, an organization founded in Wisconsin has been a watchdog of Iran's nuclear capabilities for decades.
Data and research from the Wisconsin Project on Nuclear Arms Control is being used by governments and media outlets across the globe.
Established in 1986, the organization aims to stem the spread of nuclear proliferation and other weapons of mass destruction through research and advocacy.
Valerie Lindsay is executive director of the Wisconsin Project on Nuclear Arms Control. Valerie, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you so much for having me.
The big question for the U.S., for Israel, so many others, is how much impact did these strikes have on Iran's nuclear weapons development programs? At the Wisconsin Project, how do you try to answer that question?
Well, right now, for those of us who are not operating with classified information, it's impossible to answer that question. I think there's been a great focus on, or it's easier to focus on, the success of the military strike. So did the bombs release in the right place? Did they hit their targets? Did the bombs go off in the way they were expected to? And so you have the assessment on that side. The assessment of whether the Iranian nuclear program has been obliterated, damaged, you know, how far it's been set back, that is not something that at this point we can really ascertain because of questions about how much of the equipment and of the material was damaged through the U.S. strikes and through the Israeli strikes that have been going on since June 13th.
Looking at a longer time horizon here, part of your job there at the Wisconsin Project is trying to figure out what, if anything, Iran is doing with nuclear power develop or nuclear weapons development. This is something that countries with acknowledged or unacknowledged weapons programs don't want to share with the world. What do you do to try to get information that a government like Iran doesn't want out there?
Well, we conduct investigations using open sources. So we are looking at information that governments put out. We're looking at sanctions notices. We're looking at trade data. We're looking at shipping information. We bring all of this information together, and our particular focus is looking at proliferation supply chains and sanctions evasion networks and trying to figure out who is looking to buy what types of goods, equipment, technology that can be used to make weapons of mass destruction. So that's kind of our entry point into this question.
Prior to this conflict, we'd heard from national security in this new administration, Tulsi Gabbard, downplaying the Iranian nuclear weapons program. President Trump has dismissed those statements now. Before this conflict broke out, Valerie, how would you assess what Iran was doing with nuclear weapons development?
I think we have to distinguish here between what Iran was capable of doing and what Iran's intentions were. So Iran has been capable, in our assessment, for some time in being able to make nuclear weapons if it decided to do so. The question was, had it decided to do so? And until very recently, the assessment of the U.S. intelligence community was that it had not. And that's what Tulsi Gabbard said earlier this year. Now, Israeli intelligence in the last few weeks has come out indicating that that decision has changed. It's not, as far as I'm aware, the United States has not publicly released similar intelligence. But there's no question that based on the capability, the material, the expertise, everything that Iran had accumulated over decades, that if there had been a decision to make nuclear weapons, Iran would be capable of doing that from a technical point of view.
Valerie Lindsay is with us, executive director of the Wisconsin Project on Nuclear Arms Control. Valerie, I wanted to talk to you about the organization you direct. People are listening here in Wisconsin. Why is there a Wisconsin Project on nuclear arms control? What's the history there?
Well, you know, almost 40 years ago, a law professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison named Gary Mulholland, who was working, who had worked as a judge on the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, had an idea that more needed to be done to prevent to prevent proliferation, to prevent countries from building weapons of mass destruction. And so he created the organization, and with the mission of stopping the spread of these weapons by stopping trade in items that can be used to make them. And we've been working, with that mission ever since.
And what, who are your customers for this information? Who is looking to the Wisconsin Project now to understand what's going on with nuclear proliferation?
Well, it's, we have the usual consumers and the media and, of course, the public. What we try to do as a nonpartisan research organization is provide data, information that is helping people understand sort of security risks. So we don't have a particular political agenda. We do also a lot of work with the US government, bringing our information and our analysis to countries around the world, working with export control officials in over 40 countries to do training to help them understand how to prevent proliferation by understanding a little bit more about who they're trading with.
And Valerie, growing up in the 80s, I got to say, as kids, we were very concerned about nuclear war and the potential for it. I think that concern has faded. Can you make the case to people listening now that we should be paying attention to the risk of nuclear proliferation, even thousands of miles away in countries like Iran and Israel?
We should absolutely be paying attention to it because these are the world's most destructive weapons. And even a country like North Korea, which has sort of faded from the headlines in light of everything else that's going on, has the ability to deliver a nuclear weapon to the US homeland. So there are a number of countries that are not friends of the United States who have the ability to make and deliver nuclear weapons. And we should continue to take that threat very seriously and invest in all different means that we have at our disposal to lessen that risk. So that includes everything from diplomacy to sanctions to, if necessary, things like the military strikes that we saw over the weekend.
Valerie, thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure.
That's Valerie Lindsay, Executive Director of the Wisconsin Project on Nuclear Arms Control. She's Executive Editor of Iran Watch, a website she created in 2003 to track and analyze Iran's nuclear and missile programs.
Coming up, a new memoir chronicles unmet needs in assisted living. The author's mother lived in six different facilities in Dane County.
My mother was not receiving the kind of care that she deserved, which meant that others in the same room with her were not receiving the care that they deserved.
A journey in elder care. That's next on WPR News.
This is Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Caring for an aging loved one at the end of life can be complex and confusing. For one adult daughter, it was fraught with unmet needs in assisted living facilities and in hospice.
As Judy Karofsky's mother approached her 100th birthday, she had lived in six assisted living facilities in Dane County, while Judy had stayed by her side to the end.
I functioned as the bedtime caregiver. I washed my mom's face, I removed her hearing aids, I changed her into a nightgown. Every night, I turned on a light TV program, although she really wanted to watch CNN News. I transferred her increasingly unstable body to bed. My dog and I both kissed her goodnight, and I drove home, exhausted and haunted by care lapses that could occur in my absence.
Judy Karofsky's new memoir is called Diselderly Conduct, The Flawed Business of Assisted Living and Hospice. Judy, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Kate, thank you for asking me to share this topic with your audience.
Your mother died just shy of her 100th birthday. Can you tell us about Lillian Deutsch and what she was like?
She was a spark plug. People just gravitated toward her. I'll just take you through the period after I went to college. She just walked into one of the largest corporations in America, the New England office of what was then AT&T, and said to them on the ground floor at the receptionist desk, I'm here for an interview. You have to hire me. Mm-hmm. And they did. So she had a natural tendency to understand the world around her.
What were her relationships like with her caregivers that surrounded her in these assisted living facilities?
My mom loved her caregivers. I can remember caregivers coming in, one caregiver coming in on a Sunday on her day off to take my mother to the highest floor in the facility in which she was then living so she could overlook the Madison Lakes just to spend time with her. Mm-hmm. I can remember another one who on her day off brought her newborn son for Lillian to hold.
These relationships, though, were short-lived because of the staffing turnover at these facilities. Is that right?
You're so right, Kate. And that's a problem nationally. And then, and the caregivers, although they came in with love, they wanted to help and they wanted to learn. I learned that they were not trained sufficiently. They for sure were not paid sufficiently. They were not represented. We do not have a union that serves them. So they're in many ways exploited by the business, by the industry. And in many situations, so the facility who was unable to increase its staffing level on any given day would make a call to an agency for a temporary, or many temporary caregivers, all of whom I'm sure came with the same desire to be helpful, but they didn't know the residents, they didn't know the meds, they didn't know the schedule, and they were not really helpful in the way that we needed help, that my mom needed help.
And yet at the same time, you write that there's been this explosion in assisted living facilities since 2018. Why are we seeing so many of these facilities open if they can't be properly staffed?
Why are we? Because these are businesses that are not supervised. These are businesses that have no federal oversight, no federal regulation. I can tell you that in Wisconsin, there are some regulations, but they're minimal. And until we have some oversight, this falls into the category of profiteering.
We're talking with Judy Karofsky about her new book. It's called Disorderly Conduct, The Flawed Business of Assisted Living and Hospice. And she wrote it after her mother's experience of aging and dying in these facilities in Dane County. Judy, the cost of long-term care in hospice is staggering. I mean, you paid $17,000 in rent up to facilities during your mother's last 2 months of life. Why is it so expensive?
Because it can be, quite honestly. Paying for somebody who interviewed me said, this sounds like it's just a hotel with some services. And I said, yes, that was the model at one point. And I also in the book, Kate, discuss hospice and the hospice is not, we're not charged for hospice. So if hospice becomes part of the caregiving team, that does not add an additional cost. You would think, I thought, that once hospice became part of my mother's caregiving team, there might be some reduction in the rates from the assisted living, but that didn't happen.
Your mother breaks the timeline for hospice and is kicked out of hospice. Can you talk about that rule, those rules of hospice?
Yeah. As I just said, hospice receives its funds through reimbursements from Medicare, and Medicare sets the rules. And the rules are this: people who are near death are eligible if a physician on the hospice staff, the local hospice staff, can or will determine that that person only has 6 months to live. Well, how can you do that? I mean, you can for some situations, but my mother was not suffering from either heart disease or diabetes or cancer. And it's even difficult with those three, but those are the three main medical problems that bring people to hospice. My mother had a more lingering situation. She was aging. Aging was actually what my mother was dying from. So when she was 99 and a half, they said, she's been on hospice for too long. And within 48 hours, 48 hours. They would not, the hospice nurse would not do anything with or for my mother because she was no longer a hospice recipient. I had to find a wheelchair for her. I had to keep track of her meds. I had to buy all the bandages and supplies that she would, cough medicine. She was going through a lot of cough medicine. So that was exhausting for me and quite unfortunate for my mother. At the very end of her life, she was reinstated in hospice. They did acknowledge that she had declined to the extent that hospice could be involved again.
What did this do to you and your life? You were in your 70s and
I was
being the
70s.
Point person on Care for Your Mom. Mm-hmm.
It made me aware of the failings in the industry. It made me aware of the untruths, of the deceptions. It made me aware of abuse, Kate. Unfortunately, my mother was both sexually abused in one facility and physically abused in another facility, to the point at which a police person was called. And I have pictures of those bruises. I just did one step at a time, one day at a time, because during the days, this woman was still fun. She recognized me. We did not lose that. Hmm. So I was blessed in that sense that she knew who I was when I walked in the room and her face lit up. And who would not keep coming to have that welcome every day if able to do it? And I was at that point retired and able to spend all the time with her. And she was fun. If I took her in the summer, if I took her for a wheelchair walk, she loved the gardens along the way. She knew where she was. There were certain foods that she liked to have. But underneath it was heartache because I knew that doing the best I could in this community, in a community like this one, Dane County, Madison, Wisconsin, liberal, caregiving, that my mother was not receiving the kind of care that she deserved, which meant that others next to her, with her, in the same room with her, were not deserving the care that they deserved.
How do your mother's experiences that you lived yourself, how do they inform your own choices going forward in your life?
Personally, I've recently relocated, so I no longer have a house with stairs to the basement to the laundry. I have a one floor situation, but it's not in a facility. And I'm looking ahead because I can't be blind about it to a time when I have two bedrooms. I'm sitting in one of them now, which is my office, and a caregiver will accompany me. And that's everybody's dream. It's always been the cry, no nursing homes. Of course, nursing home is sort of the generic term. And included in that is the sense that people also do not want to have to go to assisted living. But the time comes, and I listened after my mother had her stroke, and I had no choice. I could have moved into her, but there wasn't a way that I could do that given the type independent living apartment that she was in. I have no answer, but I have good thoughts. I don't know. Mm. And my hope is that those who are faced with a decision more timely than I am will pay attention and say, this is not what we can or should be doing.
Judy, thank you for sharing your story. And thank you so much for joining us.
I'm so grateful to you for bringing this issue to light to your audience today, Kate. Thank you.
That is Judy Karofsky. Her new memoir is called Disorderly Conduct, The Flawed Business of Assisted Living and Hospice.
Coming up, visit the MAC, the Monroe Arts Center, as it marks its 50th anniversary as an art hub in southern Wisconsin.
MAC is for everybody. We just need to make sure that we have all the right menu options so that we can engage our community.
That's coming up next here on WPR News.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. The Monroe Arts Center celebrates its 50th anniversary this year. It's marking the occasion with a new exhibit that explores the history of its own buildings. That includes a building from 1869, which originally served as a Methodist church in the Greene County community.
The center is a hub for arts in the southern Wisconsin area, with art exhibits and live performances. And in recent months, the center has expanded its art workshops for kids and adults, along with its educational programming.
The Art Center's director joins us now for a look at the role the organization plays in the community. Marie Perry is Executive Director of the Monroe Arts Center. Marie, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you for having me.
I want to start with this 50th anniversary exhibit, looking at the buildings that the Art Center uses, and they look pretty cool. Can you tell us a little bit about why they're important to the history of Monroe?
Absolutely. So one of the most fascinating things about how Monroe Arts Center developed is really from the community. In 1974, we had the old Methodist church that was going to be razed here and now is the central performing arts center for the Arts Center here. And the way that came about was a grassroots effort led by Peg Stiles to buy the building, renovate the building, and make that a center for the arts in Monroe. And she did that very, very effectively. And as we say, you know, it's become a center hub for our community for the last 50 years as a result of her passion.
And do I have this right? The original Methodist church was built in 1869?
Yes, and it is a beautiful structure. We just finished getting a RESA grant from the community here that is going to enable us to keep the roof in good shape, do some repainting inside, and refurbish the front doors, which, you know, is a beautiful, beautiful symbol of that building architecturally.
Well, talk us through the exhibit now. What are we going to see in the history of not just the church, but the whole, I guess, campus of the Monroe Arts Center?
One of the most fascinating things for me, my background is in visual resources and archives, and also as a children's writer and illustrator and artist. And, you know, so when you're coming into an art center and looking at their archives, their records, and trying to plan a show like this, you want to have a sense of the community that built it, what this arts center stands for. We went through newspaper clippings. You will see, you know, from the early stages, the first board of directors that formed, Peg Stiles' first leader as being a director of the Arts Center. You will see the rose window that we have as our logo being pulled out and refurbished and put back in with renovations with the church initially. And it goes and goes and goes until you get into 2019 when they opened, through Colony Brands' efforts and many other donors' efforts, an entire new addition to the building, very contemporary addition, but it allows for us to have expanded, gorgeous gallery space in our Marani and Wellington Gallery.
Now, that's some of the history. I want to turn to the present day now. And I have to admit, Marie, when I think of an art center or museum or gallery, I think, well, that's a place I go and I look at some art and then I leave. And it seems like there's a lot more going on there to bring the community in and do a lot of interesting, cool community stuff. Can you talk about that basic attitude? Yes, there is art on exhibit, but there's a lot more.
Absolutely. So we really want the community to be in our space. If that means that you're coming in to see a free gallery show and absorb what we are seeing regionally or even nationally from artists, we welcome you from Tuesday through Saturday during our hours. It's a rainy day, it's a nice day, you wanted to go downtown, you want to spend an hour up here, that's definitely an option. But we're also a center for the performing arts. So currently during the summer, we have our summer series, which are free concerts on the lawn on Wednesdays. And then as we get back into our next season, which runs about 9 months, we open in September, we are doing everything imaginable on our main stage. We are so excited to have our season opener. We will be welcoming Joseph Huber, who is a Milwaukee artist, to our stage on September 13th. And usually then once a month after that, we have a main stage act. So those are offering great opportunities as well as family and kids series that we offer on Saturday mornings, so that we're really engaging with every generation. And if I can say, one of my great missions right now is to make sure the center is a place where people learn about the arts, not only going in and seeing a gallery show, but being able to have a workshop, a youth workshop with an artist, with a performer. We're trying to build a strong youth workshop program here so that kids can start their art experience with MAC.
Yeah, why is that important to you to have this to be a place not just to come and see art, which, again, you can do, but a place where people can learn to make art and maybe have fun making art?
Being a children's writer myself and illustrator, you know, I have a big background in education. And honestly, when I think about what it took over my lifetime as an artist to mentor myself, that's every artist's story. And if you don't have somebody from the beginning when you're young, just like if you play sports, right? To get good at something, you've got to start early. Otherwise, you're not even going to know that something that stirs your soul exists. And if we can do that here with different artists and giving different opportunities, whether it's visual arts, it's creative writing, it is music, it is theater, whatever we can come to spoon-fed that initial experience, or offering grant-related experiences in the schools so we can bring a performer into our local school system here so that some of those kids, you know, that's their first taste of live theater. If we can stir the soul that way and make sure that they're aware we have these programs, we have these offerings, it's going to start something that maybe you wouldn't even know you could start. We don't all have to be artists, right? We don't all have to decide that we're gonna do this professionally. But there's a huge place for hobbies. There's a huge place for enjoyment from the arts and being a patron. So MAC is for everybody. We just need to make sure that we have all the right menu options so that we can engage our community.
Marie Perry is with us with the MAC, the Monroe Arts Center, marking their 50th anniversary this year. Marie, what is your vision for the role of the Arts Center as a part of the Monroe community?
Absolutely. Monroe is probably about an hour out of Madison. And so to make the choice to go into Madison to have some of the experiences a larger city can offer in the arts is something that I think we have a place to do here in southern Wisconsin. We have Illinois rural areas that can easily feed into our spaces here. We have rural areas within Greene County. We want to be able to offer something really important in terms of performances, in terms of gallery shows, in terms of education here, so that we can expand art into areas that aren't necessarily accessible for everyone.
I think sometimes people think of arts as something you go to the bigger city to see, right? The big museum or whatever. Why is it important to say, no, art can be anywhere?
I think it's important for art to be anywhere because if we don't make it anywhere, some people don't get the opportunity to experience the arts. If you are from a family that hasn't had a big push, you know, to know about the arts, sometimes schools are the way we can actually encourage those kids to see opportunities that they might not see from their home life. Also, just, you know, when you think about people working like we do these days, making that special effort to get an hour away, to go see an exhibit, to go have a class for your child, it just becomes harder. Accessibility really becomes an issue when we think about building in the travel time, building in the time in our family schedules to make that happen. So if MAC can be here to offer those opportunities and offer really great opportunities, it just expands the arts into every part of Wisconsin.
Marie, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Marie Perry is executive director of the MAC, the Monroe Arts Center, marking its 50th anniversary this year. Wisconsin Today producers include Mackenzie Crummy, Colleen Leahy, and Trevor Hook. Our technical directors are Lee Rayburn and Tyler Ditter. Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to WPR News.